People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life I'm fighting in, calling down to me. If you don't love it, lead it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country. Walking on the right beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life I'm fighting in a far and out of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Frank and Mom counted on each other.
What happened to that? Well, this is Paul Frome. You're on the fighting side of me here on lightresistanceradio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. There is, in the West here, an absolute war going on between the cultural Marxists pushing both a racial and a radical sexual agenda and the rest of us. The cultural Marxists want to enforce a whack job view of the world. They want to impose ideology over reality. Here's something that it might be almost hard to believe. Student barred from free speech debate for saying women don't have penises. What? And this is this is from a British newspaper, Metro News. And what's the story here? A student who was called transphobic after retweeting "women don't have penises" has been excluded from a free speech debate at Bristol University over security concerns. Yes, one of the last hideouts of along with privacy. Many were unhappy with Angelos Sophoklios after he posted the statement on his social media account last August. The tweet led to his being sacked from his role as the president of humanist students and assistant director of Durham University's Philosophy Society Journal. So he for one tweet saying what is manifestly true and obvious: women don't have penises. He is excluded from a debate for security and turfed out of several societies he belongs to. Mr. Sophoklios had hoped to take part in a panel hosted by Bristol University's Free Speech Society recently, but he claims to have been deplatformed. He wrote to the Spectator, I was looking forward to addressing these points at a panel event this week on free speech on campus, organized by the University of Bristol Free Speech Society. Unfortunately, I've now been deplatformed, which means denied opportunity to participate, which is what happens when they put you in Facebook jail or cancel your account or whatever. Mr. Sophocles also tweeted, "Nothing could provide a more ironic indication of the current status of social justice orthodoxy in academia than banning a speaker from an event entitled Free Speech on Campus." He makes a very good point. The Free Speech Society, which invited him to speak, accused Bristol Students' Union of a disregard for free speech and said they had used red tape to stop him speaking. It said, "The justification given is that his presence on campus constitutes a high risk." Does it constitute a risk, or is there a risk from crazy, unhinged people who might try to harm him? The University Security Service informed us that they were not at all consulted by the student union on the matter. The student union hit back and said it had not refused Mr. Sophocles as a speaker, and it was committed to freedom of speech. A spokesman said Bristol Student Union and the University of Bristol have a joint external speakers procedure which applies to all bookings and events. Bristol Student Union made an initial assessment of the speaker and recommended that security would be needed to ensure this event could run safely and smoothly. The Freedom of Speech Society was informed of this 1 week prior to the event, but the recommendation is that the event be rearranged in order to allow security measures to be put in place in the event to go ahead. It sounds like a last minute catch up. A British Labour member of Parliament, John McConnell, has gotten himself into some trouble with what he said was an offhand remark. But the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, who doesn't have much going for her, reacted furiously when Member of Parliament John McConnell said that Winston Churchill was a villain. And this is the letter from former Canadian diplomat Ian MacDonald to the Sunday Telegraph. Churchill as war criminal? "Dear sir, court historians, mainstream media, and Zionist politicians may cringe when confronted by Member of Parliament John McConnell's exposure of Churchill's perfidy, but truth in history, however belated, is surely well served thereby. The truth is that Churchill was even worse than a mere villain. He was arguably the most profoundly evil war criminal of all time, also probably the greatest con artist ever, spellbinding whole otherwise sane populations into thinking World War II was a splendid idea, even though the catastrophic experience of World War I was still within recent memory, except among guileless teenagers blinded by patriotism and propaganda to common sense and self-preservation. Just as guilty as the sinister Churchill were his colleagues and others with access to him, who surely knew of his lethally traitorous side, but were too cowardly or politically correct to finish him off. His hero image is still virtually untouchable by the media, thanks to his indispensable service to the Zionists and ardent devotion to their cause." I'll get to that when I finish Mr. Ian MacDonald's letter. "In 1939, Churchill and his war party campaigned for war against Germany, in the full knowledge that the threat to Western civilization was Bolshevik Russia, not our cultured-friendly Christian German kinfolk. Clear confirmation of his perfidy emerged when Germany and Russia invaded Poland, and Churchill contrived to declare war only on Germany when the occasion called for neutrality and eventually a NATO-style alliance to overthrow the menacing Soviet dictatorship. Britain had a second chance to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat in 1940 when Hitler offered a munificent peace treaty that would have saved the British Empire and millions of lives. But Churchill, inflamed by hatred, imparted by his secret Zionist paymasters and his megalomania complex, rejected the offer. For this calamitous, contrived blunder and his many other costly decisions, that bastard Churchill, as he was known, to colleagues who understood him, does not deserve enshrinement as a great Allied leader, but rather should be condemned in perpetuity as an arch-traitor and warmonger supreme, who created incalculable, unnecessary loss and suffering and destroyed Germany, the mainstay of our Western Christian civilization and the most advanced nation on earth. Churchill was disingenuous to claim that not until after the war did he realize he had made a mistake. A few decades earlier, he had written harsh condemnations of Jewish Bolshevism and was well aware of its genocidal totalitarianism, despite which he warmly embraced the sinister, scheming dictator Stalin. Churchill's image as a competent and fearless leader, therefore, is a myth that can be demolished easily by any competent objective researcher. The myth originated when Churchill was sent to South Africa as a young correspondent to cover the Anglo-Boer War. To create a story, he persuaded a gullible local British commander to send an armored troop train into Boer territory and take him along. The Boers easily captured the train, taking the troops and Churchill prisoner. Churchill, left unguarded, escaped and was given a hero's welcome, while the British commander was reprimanded for his folly. The notoriety helped Churchill win a seat in Parliament, and eventually appointment as the first Lord of the Admiralty in the first during the World War I, where he revealed his incompetence in the Dardanelles campaign, where thousands of Australians and New Zealanders were mindlessly sacrificed in a hopeless assault, a stupidity Churchill repeated a generation later, when he sent Canadian soldiers to be slaughtered on the impassable beach at Dieppe. Yeah, these people were sacrificed. The Dardanelles is this is a strait that runs through Turkey, linking the Black Sea with the Mediterranean. It was heavily fortified, and the Allied troops, mostly the Anzacs, that's the Australian New Zealanders, had to attack from an airstrip of beach up a steep cliff. Well, guess who was up at the top of the cliff with machine gun fire and rifle fire? Well, the Turks, and it was a slaughter. But he was a dreadful commander. In the mid-30s, the discredited warmonger, after accepting large payments from Jewish American millionaires to stave off his impending bankruptcy, formed a group known as the War Party that strongly urged Britain to make war on Germany. After war was declared and the British Army defeated, Britain was left defenseless, but spared by the pro-British Hitler, who magnanimously offered Britain an honorable peace that would have preserved the empire fully intact with German military protection if required. As a gesture of good faith, he made possible the miracle of Dunkirk. And the miracle of Dunkirk was, here was the retreating, defeated BEF, British Expeditionary Force, on the beaches of France, being evacuated, and they didn't have the shipping to evacuate them, so they were practically sending out rowboats, any boat that could float, from Britain to pick up these soldiers. Now, what could Hitler have done? Well, he could have basically shot at the incoming boats, driven them off, and the remainder of the British Army could have been either massacred or would have to surrender ignominiously. He didn't. He let them get away. Not because he didn't have the military force to stop them, because he didn't want a massacre. He still wanted peace, which was exactly what Hitler did not want. I'm sorry, Churchill did not want. Churchill contemptuously and contemptibly rejected the peace offer, sealing the fate of hundreds of millions, dooming Western Christian civilization and sacrificing his country, simply to satisfy his quest for supreme warlord and to satisfy his Zionist paymasters. As for courage, he was a coward, cynically trashing the lives of innocent subjects, military and civilian, while ensuring his own safety. During the Blitz, Churchill would leave London when intelligence informed of an impending Luftwaffe attack, then return to bomb sites as soon as the raid ended for photo ops, giving the impression he had shared the danger. To satisfy his anti-German bloodlust and ensure, however belatedly, the war was finally ending, his place as the most indefatigably sadistic war criminal of World War II, he ordered the firebombing of the undefended city of Dresden, which is what I talked about earlier this week. We celebrated the 74th anniversary of this war crime on Wednesday this week. Knowing it was packed with women and children fleeing the rapacious Red Army, and that most would be burned alive in the Holocaust. WC, that's Wing Commander Giff Gifford of St. John, New Brunswick, who unwittingly led an RCAF squadron in the diabolical attack, said upon learning of the purpose and result of the raid, told the Senate's Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Valor and Horror Video Inquiry that he felt remorse every day for the rest of his life for the murder of the innocents and the obliteration of one of Europe's, the world's most beautiful architectural treasures, and that's the city of Dresden. Churchill was my childhood hero, for whom I was literally, by enlisting an air crew, prepared to die. And actually, he was one of my childhood heroes. I remember when he died in 1965, going down to the British consulate in Toronto. This is Paul Fromm talking, not Ian MacDonald. And with tears in my eyes, signing the condolence book. You know, I mean, I bought into this nonsense. Ian MacDonald continues. I now see him for what he was, a drunken, unscrupulous, corrupt, cynical, sadistic, immoral, self-serving arch-traitor. Ironically, it was his nation's would-be savior, the much-reviled Adolf Hitler, whom I was taught to hate, who graciously offered an optimum solution which would have handed Britain not only a real victory, but also liberated Stalin's terrified subjects and made possible a permanent Pax Germanicus Britannicus Americanus, which would have freed the Western democracies from rule by cunning, parasitical, hostile, duplicitous, powerful enemy within, against whom Hitler had repeatedly warned, who are a far greater threat to our survival and freedom than ever posed by a resurgent, friendly Christian Germany whose people shared our values, writes Ian MacDonald, former Canadian diplomat. Churchill became an icon by combining perfidious chutzpah with unmatched eloquence. But as a statesman, he was hardly more competent than Angela Merkel and couldn't hold a candle to Canada's Mackenzie King or Hitler, for that matter. Many young Canadians of my era fell for his oratory and paid with their lives. Had post-war war justice prevailed, Churchill would have been charged and convicted and hanged as the greatest war criminal of World War II, if not of all time. By prolonging the war, instead of accepting Hitler's generous offer, of an honorable peace in 1940, he caused 150 million unnecessary casualties, incalculable suffering, destroyed Britain, the country he pretended to save, eliminated Christian Germany as a bulwark against this genocidal Soviet dictatorship, betrayed Poland into Stalin's clutches, and calamitously, as it turned out, abandoned the innocent Palestinians to the tender mercies of the ruthless racist Zionists. I'll get to that in a moment. He set the stage for the Cold War, Middle East wars, Third World chaos, ethnic conflict, refugee invasions, and subversion of the Western Christian democracies, leaving them under Jewish hegemony, a much more deadly threat to their traditions, freedom, and ultimate survival than any posed by Hitler's Germany. Had it not been for Churchill's diabolical treachery, the world today would be in every respect a far safer place. And I read a book by Herbert Gilbert, I believe, about Churchill's connection with Zionism. In an age when Jews in Britain were not very popular in general, Churchill was already very pro-Jewish. In fact, he incurred the wrath of his cousin, who said to him on one occasion, this was Lord Douglas, famous for his confrontation with the playwright and author excuse me a sec. It's the cold season. anyway, he chided him for betraying his class. Churchill would go on to represent a largely Jewish constituency in the Midlands, and he was a strong Zionist, that is, a person trying to create a Jewish state in a land that was inhabited by mostly by non-Jews, by the Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim. And he devoted himself to that right up until the actual creation of the State of Israel. And during his time in the cabinet, in the First and later in the Second World War, and of course as Prime Minister, he did a great deal to help bring about the State of Israel. Part of it, though, you know, whether he actually believed that, it's hard to know. And perhaps doesn't really matter one way or the other. However, he certainly was a tireless campaigner for this, for Israel. Even though it meant the marginalization, let's say, of the Palestinian people. And what had happened is that he fell into serious debt because of his gambling, and was in the 1930s likely to lose his prized residence called Checkers, our country home. And made him vulnerable, and Jewish money forwarded through Czech intelligence bailed him out, and became an absolute disaster. He was a corrupted man, and Ian MacDonald, who well lived through that era as a young man, is very forthright about just how much people bought into Churchill's rhetoric at the time. There are other things that people hold against Churchill. This is not the list. Unfortunately, was not exhaustive, but his conduct, or what he was mostly praised for, that is his conduct in World War II, it was a disgrace. Particularly, as Ian MacDonald points out, that we didn't have to go to war. Hitler was not trying to, quote, you know, conquer the world. The conquest of the British Isles was not something he wanted to do. In fact, even after a year and a half of hostilities, a year of hostilities, I guess, in 1940, after the calamitous British defeat in France and the ignominious retreat in almost anything that would float from France, the so-called flotilla, Hitler still offered Britain an honorable peace that would allow it to keep its empire, and he thought of a continent of Europe dominated by Germany, the British Empire and much of the rest of the world dominated, of course, by Britain, and that was what he saw, and that's what he offered. In fact, although Churchill said something to the effect, "I was not elected to preside over the dismemberment of the British Empire," in fact, that's exactly what happened. 20 years after World War II, the main components of the British Empire were gone. By 1965, independence had been given to British India, which includes now present-day Pakistan and Bangladesh, as well as India. The British Empire, of course, had well, India was the jewel of the crown, and the various countries in Africa, the Gold Coast, which would become Ghana, Tanganyika, which would become Tanzania, the Federation of Rhodesia and Malawi, which would become Zambia, the Federation of the Rhodesias and Nyasaland, which would become Nyasaland would become Malawi, and of course the white settlers in southern Rhodesia, which would be called, eventually become the independent nation of Rhodesia for 14 years. All of this was gone from the man who, by the time he died, he had seen the results of his action. The British did not win World War II. In fact, they lost it. Germany didn't win, of course. The whole West lost. In fact, the terms that the Americans forced the British to agree to was that within short order, after the end of the war, the British Empire would be dismantled. Exactly the same demands of the communists. So who was Britain's friend? Winston Churchill or the man they loved to hate, Adolf Hitler? This is Caroline Yeager is an expert on World War II, and she's always very perceptive. And here's one of her recent essays. And this is how British psychological warfare resulted in short-term victory, but long-term loss for Europe. An objective view of World War II is that this was an unmitigated catastrophe for Europe. For Germany, of course, which was defeated. For France, which was would be largely occupied by the Americans at the end of the war and suffered a particular nasty rash of rapes. A victory of sorts for the resurgent Soviet Union that managed to gobble up for almost half a century most of Eastern Europe. Britain lost its empire. No, World War II was an unmitigated loss for all of Europe. Victor Cavendish Bentinck, a senior British intelligence official during World War II, serving as chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, doubted and even dismissed the reports coming in about homicidal gas chambers used in National Socialist Germany. The information contained in the following research article, written by a British nationalist but signed by a pseudonym, needs to be better known. It is a good companion article to this one, which reveals the British elite. That's government, the BBC, media, Church of England, as unscrupulous liars and conscienceless competitors in the mold of international Jewry. The article below explains the secret intelligence agencies at work in Great Britain and how they interacted in regard to creating the illusion of German criminal behavior. I've personally found over and over in my continuing study of World War I and II the British preference for psychological warfare over soldiery and battlefield victories, and that those who carry it out don't care who or what they destroy in the process of, quote, winning. That is the secret of their success. And that's Caroline Yeager. Anyway, and this is an essay in tribute to Robert Forrest on his 88th birthday, Britain's Rumor Factory, Origins of the Gas Chamber Story. For more than 30 years, historians have been aware of one secret memoranda by senior British intelligence official Victor Cavendish Bentinck, in which he casts doubt on the alleged use of homicidal gas chambers in National Socialist Germany. Writing to Whitehall colleagues at the end of August 1, 1943, Cavendish Bentinck used dismissive language which today in most European countries would undoubtedly see him prosecuted as a Holocaust denier. During the trial of British historian David Irving's libel action against Deborah Lipstadt in 2000, now dramatized in the Hollywood movie Denial, some of Cavendish Bentinck's remarks were raised by Irving as justification of his claim that the gas chamber story originated as a propaganda lie. In his judgment against Irving, Mr. Justice Gray accepted the counterarguments of Lipstadt's defense team. Their interpretation has since appeared in a book by Professor Sir Richard Evans, who is among Lipstadt's defense witnesses. 17 years on from the Irving Lipstadt trial, it's now possible to access a broader range of British documents, including intelligence material. In this essay, I shall attempt to clarify what these documents tell us about the role of British propaganda and intelligence in relation to the initial allegations of homicidal gassing by National Socialist Germany. The conclusions can be briefly summarized. Britain's political warfare executive and its predecessor first deployed stories of homicidal gassing as part of propaganda efforts in two areas unconnected to the treatment of Jews. Their objective was to spread dissension and demoralization among German soldiers and civilians, and among Germany's allies. Partly because they knew of these earlier propaganda initiatives, Victor Cavendish Bentinck and his British intelligence colleagues, their colleague Roger Allen, disbelieved later stories that homicidal gas chambers had been used to murder Poles and Jews. They succeeded in having these allegations removed from the draft of a joint Anglo-American declaration on German crimes in Poland, which was published on the 30th of August, 1943. Part 1, the First Revisionists. In August 1943, Poland's government in exile lobbied the British and American governments to issue a public statement condemning, quote, German terror in Poland. Maury McLaren, head of the Polish section of Britain's main propaganda body, the Political Warfare Executive, or PWE, advised the Foreign Office in confidence that from his contacts with the Poles, he recently gained the impression that they are becoming seriously worried lest the Germans might shortly succeed in persuading Polish dissidents to come forward and even form some kind of interim government. The present Polish request may possibly have some connection to these fears. So in other words, lay on the propaganda. Moreover, Britain's own SOE, or Special Operations Executive, responsible for organizing and supplying Polish underground fighters, reported that German anti-partisan operations were increasingly successful in affecting their work, in that the cells of the underground resistance movement in the affected areas are to a great extent liquidated, and materials delivered are liable to be discovered. The Special Operations Executive would accordingly welcome any form of deterrent that could be devised. In other words, we're losing, so we need to lay on the propaganda. Dennis Allen of the Foreign Office's Central Department, not to be confused with the unrelated Roger Allen, who also figures in this story, suggested that a statement should be issued with, quote, some indication that the actions being carried out by the German authorities in Poland will in some measure be held against Germany as a whole. With the British Parliament in its summer recess and Prime Minister Winston Churchill on his way to Quebec for a secret summit with U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, the most logical opportunity would be for a joint Anglo-American statement issued to the press rather than to Parliament, you know, which is sneaky. The font of power in the UK is Parliament. Allen's department had prepared a draft statement which was discussed with the Poles. This condemned the brutality of German anti-partisan operations involving mass deportations in the Lublin area of southeastern Poland. The draft statement, which made no reference to Jews and seemed to relate to Polish civilians, alleged, quote, some children are killed on the spot, others are separated from their parents and either sent to Germany to be brought up as Germans or sold to German settlers or dispatched with the women and old men to detention camps where they are being systematically put to death in gas chambers. And this is untrue, Carolyn Yeager says. His Majesty's government reaffirm their resolve to punish the instigators and actual perpetrators of these crimes. They further declared that so long as such atrocities continue to be committed by the representatives and in the name of Germany, they must be taken into account against the time of the final settlement with Germany. Meanwhile, the war against Germany will be prosecuted with the utmost vigor until the barbarous Hitlerite tyranny has finally been overthrown. So this was the press statement they put out. By August 27th, this draft had been agreed with the Americans and was planned for release 3 days later. A copy was handed to the Soviets. However, at this 11th hour, the intelligence side of Whitehall, that's the Foreign Office, stepped in. The Joint Intelligence Committee had evolved shortly before the war and stood between the political and military consumers of intelligence and the organizations responsible for obtaining it, including MI6, MI5, GC and CS, today known as the GCHQ. One former Joint Intelligence Committee chairman describes its role as the final arbiter of intelligence, in a phrase which might equally apply today to historians. Its wartime chairman and secretary wrote that the JIC had an important task in ensuring that information and sources were assessed with critical impartiality. In the political departments, that is the Foreign Office and Colonial Office, the officials who receive, collate, and assess information are also responsible for formulating policy. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but the system does possess a serious weakness. One who is concerned in devising and recommending policy and in assisting its execution is likely, however objective he may try to be, to interpret the intelligence he receives in light of the policies he's pursuing. To correct this possible weakness, it's clearly desirable that some quite objective check be placed on all intelligence received. We believe that no department, however experienced and well-staffed, has anything to lose by bringing the intelligence directly available to it to the anvil of discussion and appreciation among workers in the same field. You see, what he's saying is intelligence or information has to be assessed. During the war years, the JIC was headed by Victor Cavendish Bentinck, who was also in charge of the Services Liaison Department of the Foreign Office, where his right man was Roger Allen, a pre-war barrister. Since its creation in July 1942, Roger Allen had also served as Joint Secretary to the War Cabinet's Committee on the Treatment of War Criminals. Rather belatedly, on the 27th of August, with the draft statement almost ready for release, Roger Allen raised the alarm, pointing out that the statement seemed to be mainly based on an aide memoir supplied by the Polish government in exile. While he accepted that with regard to deportations of Polish citizens, the general picture painted is pretty true to life, he warned Cavendish Bentinck. On the other hand, it is of course extremely difficult, if not impossible, for us to check on specific instances or matters of detail. For this reason, I feel a little unhappy about the statement to be issued on the authority of His Majesty's government that Poles are now being systematically put to death in gas chambers. The gas chambers reference seemed to be based on two references in the Polish aid memoir appendix, but supposedly drawn from telegrams sent from Poland on the 17th of July 1943. The first telegram stated in relation to deportees sent to the Majdanek camp, Commander-in-Chief Armed Forces Lublin District informed me that he had evidence that some of these people are being murdered in gas cells here. There. By Commander-in-Chief, this telegram presumably meant the district commander of the Polish Underground Army. The second telegram stated, it has been ascertained that on July 2nd and 5th, two transports made of women, children, and old men, consisting of 30 wagons each, have been liquidated in gas cells. Roger Allen pointed out to Cavendish Bentinck, it will be observed that the first of these reports gives no indication of the date of the occurrence or the number of people concerned. The second is silent as to the place of the source. It is true that there have been references to the use of gas chambers in other reports, but these references have usually, if not always, being equally vague and since of being concerned with the extermination of Jews have usually emanated from Jewish sources. Personally, I've never really understood the advantage of the gas chamber over a simple machine gun. And this is, of course, something many people have pointed out as they dissect the Holocaust tales. Or the equally simple starvation method. These stories may or may not be true, but in any event, I submit we are putting out a statement on evidence which is far from conclusive, and which we have no means of assessing. However, you may not consider this of sufficient importance to warrant any action. Cavendish Benting wasted no time in passing this analysis on later that day to the Foreign Office top brass, adding his own skeptical note. In my opinion, it is incorrect to describe Polish information regarding German atrocities as trustworthy. The Poles, and to a far greater extent the Jews, tend to exaggerate German atrocities in order to stoke us up. They seem to have succeeded. Isn't that an interesting statement? That neither the Polish information nor the Jewish information is trustworthy because they tend to exaggerate German atrocities in order to stoke us up. Mr. Allen and myself have both followed German atrocities quite closely. I do not believe that there is any evidence that which would be accepted in a court of law that Polish citizens are being killed on the spot by Germans when their parents were being deported to Germany, nor that Polish children are being sold to German settlers. As regards putting Poles to death in gas chambers, I do not believe there is any evidence that has been done. There have been many stories to this effect, and we played them up in PWE rumors without believing that they have any foundation. At any rate, there is far less evidence than exists for the mass murder of Polish officers by the Russians at Katyn. On the other hand, we do know the Germans are out to destroy Jews of any age unless they are fit for manual labor. Carol Yeager comments, how do they know that? Only by inference. I think that we weaken our case against the Germans by publicly giving credence to atrocity stories for which there is no evidence. These mass executions in gas chambers reminded me of the stories of employment of human corpses during the last war for the manufacture of fat, which was a grotesque lie and led to the true stories of German atrocities being brushed aside as mere propaganda. I'm very sad to see that we must needs ape the Russians and talk about Hitlerite instead of German. I find that it's very interesting because that in the early days, this was also an accusation brought against Germany that corpses were reduced, rendered of their fat and made into soap. Well, this turns out actually to be a World War I outrageous atrocity story, which turned out just not to be true. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I'm going to play a song with Rhonda Vincent, along with Dallas Fraser and Charles Raines. It's called Beneath Still Waters. And maybe it'd be a good idea if we start from the beginning.
There's a strong undertow. The surface won't tell you what the deep water knows. Darling, I'm saying I know something's wrong beneath the water. Your love is gone. Even a fool could see that you don't believe in me. This time
That's Rhonda Vincent. This is Bill Anderson. I wonder if God likes country music.
We've talked a lot today about our friends at the Grand Ole Opry as we salute the Grand Ole Opry on Country's Family Reunion. I don't think anybody has mentioned the name of Roy Acuff, but I want to do that because some of my greatest memories of being on the Opry were the nights that Mr. Roy would come out on the stage and allow me to share the spotlight with him and do this song right here. I got a lot of wonderful memories. If we have time, I'll share some of you. But first, I'd like to do the song, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope maybe you remember. One night, we were out on tour getting ready to do a show. And at the time, it really wasn't anything all that special. It was what you might call just another one-night stand. When I looked over my guitar, and there stood an old man. His cowboy clothes were frayed and worn, and his roots were far from near. He said, I'd like to sit in with your band. You see, I'm a country singer too. Yeah, well, we just all had a big laugh. When I looked back at the old man, there was a tear in his eye. So I told the band to coo, because I didn't want to see him cry. He reached down and he took my guitar. With a determined look on his face. But then as he started to play and sing, a look of sadness took its place. He said, I've sang my songs from Maine to California. Sing the world through the window of a car. Made a dime back when I made it, never saved a dime. I always thought so, I'd be a star. But now my voice is cracked and no one wants me. My wife gave up on me years ago. It's been so long, my kid don't even know me. American singer is the only life I know. And then he said, I wonder if he likes country music. Will there be a place up there to sing my song? Will he make my fingers nimble like they used to be? So I can play the chord and sing along. I wonder if God likes country music.
I just stood there.
Will there be a
none of us really knew what to say. He took my old guitar and he sat it down ever so gently. And then as he turned to leave, the band stood up with applause. But I can still hear his words today.
I wonder if God likes country music.
Great song by John Conley and, of course, Whispering Bill Anderson, I Wonder If God Loves Country Music. And I do believe he does. It's a great song. I kind of think this is a religious song, too, by Lacey J. Dalton. Turn to the One, Lacey J. Paul Frog. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhatResistanceRadio.com.
You know you'll never find your way.
Tracy J. Dalton, Turn to the One. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, this is Paul Fromm. I'll be back with you again tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. The Maple Leaf, forever, our real anthem.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.